Secondly, of course, that doesn't mean for a second that those with a faith of whatever type it is, including the Christian faith, shouldn't bring those convictions to the public square. So the separation of church and state is not the separation of faith and values. Okay, that's a bit of a misnomer and a false category error, if you like. So Christians, like everyone, should be bringing everything they believe in, which is fundamental to who they are, to the table and to the public square.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
I'm your host, Todd Funk, with Thinking Matters, and today I have the pleasure and honor to interview Max Jagannathan. He's a senior research fellow at the Center for Public Christianity in Australia. He's worked as a lawyer and a policy advisor. He's an associate at Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics, and he's spoken at both universities and corporate organizations, political institutions. He's spoken for Samsung and Lego and Goldman Sachs even. And in his free time, at least his website says he's finishing his law degree. Is that about right, Max?
Yeah, my PhD in law.
PhD in law. Oh, well, welcome to the show, Max. It's good to have you, buddy.
Thanks so much, Todd. Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Yeah. And so I know, Max, I had the pleasure of hosting him around a few years ago when he was a keynote for the Thinking Matters conferences. And so I just get on with him like a house on fire. But Max, I remember asking you then, and probably the listeners and watchers will want to know exactly what does it mean to be a research fellow at the Center for Public Christianity in Australia? What do you do? What's your day to day?
Yeah, thanks, Todd. And yeah, it's great to reconnect again. And that was a fun trip.
It was.
To be with you again. Yeah, look, it's basically in its simplest form, my current role is to be a speaker and a writer. And so we do a few different things at CPX, the Center for Public Christianity here in Australia. We write primarily for mainstream media outlets, so for mainly newspapers, online magazines, journals, those sorts of things. So we write opinion editorial articles and columns. Second thing we do is speak, so public speaking, and you referred to some of the places that I've spoken at. So we speak at businesses and schools and universities, churches, conferences, wherever we get invited.
What do you do? I mean, I could see you. I mean, what do you do at businesses? What do you tell them? What do you talk about?
Yeah, so I mean, at CPX, our mission and our focus is really to communicate something of the truth, beauty, and goodness of the Christian message through the big questions and big issues of the day. So we're trying to identify cultural trends and cultural currents. We're trying to look at what the things are that people are already thinking a bit about and talking about, whether that's, you know, the cost of living crisis or housing affordability or geopolitical uncertainty or war or contemporary debates around other cultural issues. And then we try and offer some analysis, some insight, some commentary, and ultimately some commendation of the Christian message, specifically in how it relates to one or more of those things. So we're trying to meet people where they are. It's kind of similar to what Paul does in Acts 17, where he goes to Athens and kind of makes direct reference when he's speaking there to the issues and the cultural touch points and the frames of understanding that they already have. So it can be seen as kind of public theology, if you like, or bringing a Christian and a faith-based lens to some of the big issues that people are dealing with broadly. So not just people that might call themselves Christian, but all people.
Okay. And as a percentage, how often are you speaking with what you'd consider a, quote, Christian audience? And how often are you speaking with, you know, just unknowns, a corporate?
Look, that's a good question. I mean, CPX, for our mission, we are trying to speak to people who might not call themselves Christian, ideally between 90 and 100% of the time. So we're very much a world-facing organization. We have a street-facing and a world-facing and a public media-facing posture. But of course, you know, our work includes audiences that would call themselves Christian as well. But the way we speak and the way we tailor our content is that we are there for everyone. And of course, we're very happy to encourage and equip Christians, but we're really there to try and channel something of the message of Christianity and the Christian story for those who probably don't call themselves Christians.
Okay. And how did you fall into what you're currently doing in your track, you know, and in your interest in politics and law and that kind of thing? I mean, how did you get to where you are?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you don't plan these things, Todd. I'm sure you're.
No, that's for sure. I came to be a New Zealand minister for a couple of years from California, you know, and here I am 22 years later.
Right. There you go. Just across the ocean, you know, doing interesting things. So yeah, I certainly didn't plan any of it. You just kind of take one step after the other and you take opportunities prayerfully and thoughtfully as best you can. And I, as you, you know, alluded to, I started life as a lawyer and I practiced law for a few years and I worked in professional politics for 7 or 8 years, I think. And then, yeah, it took some time after my wife and I got married and did some postgraduate study where I studied theology and philosophy and in the United Kingdom. And then, you know, that's when I kind of shifted into this area of work in kind of speaking and writing in this kind of public Christianity, public theology space. And so it really happened in an organic way. There wasn't some massive pivot or deviation or shift, just one small step at a time. And I think while law, politics and public theology might not seem to go together, there's a lot of parallels and commonalities. You know, they all involve a contested space. They all involve kind of deconstructing issues to their first principles. They all involve working with and, you know, ideally respecting and coming alongside people with very differing views to you. And so thankfully I've been relatively well-schooled and well-trained and well-experienced with all of those things. And each of my three career phases, at least to date, I don't know what comes next, have kind of reinforced each other in more ways than I would have assumed.
Wow. Oh, that's very interesting. You have a unique background, going way back. I don't know if we get into that, but just, yeah, very unique background that brings you to where you are. And so because you have such a broad expertise of different topics and politics and whatnot, I, as an American, have a question that's for me. It's for Todd.
Sure.
And it has to do with, you know, In the United States, you'd have to be under a rock if you didn't notice the great debates going on about immigration and, of course, the recent riots and protests going on in Los Angeles.
Mm.
Max, where do you personally land with that as a Christian? Because I know Christians on both sides, you know, that Jesus would have welcomed the foreigner and you know, that. And then I see others that, no, we've got to protect and defend and close the borders. I don't know. Is there an easy? No, there's not an easy answer. But what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I think that's an important thing to explicitly acknowledge right up front, that there is not an easy answer and there is clearly not a clear answer either. Otherwise, people far smarter than, you know, you and I would have already found it. And so I do feel for, you know, those in the United States at the moment, a country that, you know, I really love the United States. I have a lot of family there. I have cousins there. I've lived there.
Have you?
Yes, yeah, I have. When I was a student, I did some exchange time there.
But what state? Where were you?
A University of Alabama.
Alabama, Tuscaloosa. The deep south, man.
Roll Tide.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good on you.
So, yeah, look, my heart really does go out. Obviously, you know, the people of the United States are going through a lot and there's a lot to work out and there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of unrest. And so I think on an issue as difficult as immigration, I certainly don't presume to have the answer for them. But if I could just offer, you know, just some thoughts in response to your question. The first thing, as I already alluded to, is for people who call themselves Christian, they've got to be willing to disagree on this. I don't believe that there is a Christian response or a Christian position on this issue. I think the reason that the Bible targets the human heart is that it's not supposed to be exclusively and exhaustively used as an instrument of government. It's supposed to be an instrument and a pathway to relationship with God and relationships with one another and the transformation of individual hearts and minds. And so that's not unrelated to government, but it's important to remember that, you know, the Christian message is about the invasion of hearts and minds, not the invasion of laws and policies. So that's the first point. Secondly, of course, that doesn't mean for a second that those with a faith of whatever type it is, including the Christian faith, shouldn't bring those convictions to the public square in discussing public policy issues and including an issue like immigration. So the separation of church and state is not the separation of faith and values. Okay. That's a bit of a misnomer and a false category error, if you like. So Christians, like everyone, should be bringing everything they believe in, which is fundamental to who they are, to the table and to the public square. For something like immigration, there are, as there always seems to be when bringing theological insight to a public policy issue, there are countervailing arguments and forces. One is, as you correctly mentioned, the Christian imperative and the call and the mandate even to reach out to the foreigner, to the immigrant, to the outcast, to the disadvantaged. And I think any position on immigration policy that doesn't imbue that as a fundamental ideal is problematic from a Christian perspective. At the same time, there are also very clear biblical principles about responsible stewardship and property rights and, you know, building communities of flourishing. And that speaks to the other side of the immigration debate, which is that you can't just have open border policies that is irresponsible and reckless and ridiculous, and that dishonors the domestic population. If you're just inviting people in out of the goodness of your heart, but then you don't, you know, thoughtfully provide the infrastructure to take care of them properly and to host them properly and to care for your own people at the same time, then that's problematic too. So suffice to say, I think there are good Christian arguments on both sides of the immigration debate, but there are no Christian arguments that seem to support the far left and the far right flank of that debate.
And that's a good insight there.
Yeah, and so I think you've got to, as is often the case, you've got to come through the middle, you've got to have nuance, you've got to have insight, and there are biblical principles that speak to both sides. Yeah. And I think if you look around the world, the countries that have got immigration right, and that's a different podcast, but they are countries that have, whether they consider themselves influenced by the Christian ideals or not, they are countries that have taken from both sides in that, in a genuinely biblical sense. It's a more holistic approach that understands the need to care for the foreigner and the disadvantaged, and also the need to steward infrastructure and resources well and care for local communities as well.
Do you think the Aussies have got it right or close?
No, certainly not. We're still working at it here.
Still working at it.
And you know, we don't have riots here at the moment, but we have almost identical tensions in our immigration debate that goes back 50 or 60 years at least, you know, since the Second World War. So this is not a uniquely American problem. America is one of the largest and the most powerful and prominent market democracy in the world. And so that's why when you guys are dealing with stuff, it's more prominent globally. But I think most countries, most market economies, you know, that have had big immigration intakes for the last 100 years or so have almost identical debates. Similar arguments
all over the world.
It's a tough one. I don't think anyone's got it perfectly right. We just have to keep at it and do it graciously.
Have you written anything on it or spoken on it? I mean, and did you get to just speak or talk about whatever suits your fancy, or do you get told what to research?
That would be nice. Look, to some degree, there is a lot of freedom. I'm really fortunate in this role to be able to follow interests and expertise, my interests and my expertise and experience. But often what we write on and what we speak on is determined by, you know, what we're invited to speak on and what's going to resonate in a publishable sense with the public square and the mainstream media. On this particular issue, I've certainly spoken on it. I haven't written on it. No, on immigration. It's a tricky one, but I've done some training and some speaking in schools to young people, to students, really just setting down some of those first principles and frameworks through which they can think through the issues. It's a tricky one because the role that I'm in, you know, I'm not a politician. I'm not trying to run an agenda, but what we are trying to do is to improve the debate, to elevate the debate, to make sure people are thinking about the right things and they're thinking through tricky issues like this in biblically faithful and socially and politically responsible ways, regardless of what their view on a particular issue might end up being. So on something like this, I think a Christian voice in the public square, there's a lot to be said for a need for a Christian voice in the public square to help and support and encourage people in how to think rather than what to think.
Right. And how do you navigate? There's just a real fine line. I mean, when I hear Christian in the public square or political arena, I think, oh, there's an unwanted individual. There's a voice that's going to be silenced. There's the religious fanatic. I mean, how do you navigate those treacherous gator filled waters?
Yeah, there's plenty of gators out there. And some of the gators are probably warranted because of how some of us who call ourselves Christians in the past have treated the public square and have treated political power and cultural influence, or, you know, when we perhaps had much more of it than we do now. And so some of the bashing, you know, that we might get is completely warranted and justified. And a lot of it I don't think is. It's based on, as I mentioned earlier, kind of misunderstandings of the difference between separation of church and state and faith and values and those sorts of things. I think we've got to be out there and the Christian voice, if we truly are running an open democracy and an open society that's all inclusive of ideas, then it's got to be inclusive of Christian ideas as well. And a colleague of mine, I just wrote an article in a National Australian newspaper recently making this exact point that whether you're atheist or Christian or otherwise, every person should be bringing all of their convictions and beliefs and values to the table, to the public square. And for an atheist not to bring their atheism to a public debate would be a betrayal of who they are and insincere and inauthentic, in the same way that if, you know, you asked a Christian to check their beliefs at the door or check their faith at the door, that would be equally ridiculous. So I think we've got to really learn to do better at coexisting with people and sharing a public square with people with whom we might not always agree with. And I think that applies to people of all faiths and no faith.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I would think that's easier for us as Christians to remind ourselves and be gracious and hospitable and all that stuff. But what do you do when you walk into what you know is an overtly kind of a hostile environment, a very, I don't know, I won't define, but just hostile.
Yeah. And look, one thing the Bible promises is that there are going to be hostile environments.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be an added layer of difficulty for people who call themselves Christian just by virtue of the fact that we call ourselves Christian. And so I think I don't want to just gloss over it, but I think when we believe in these scriptures and we have this faith and in those very scriptures that anchor our faith and from which we draw the revelation, a lot of the revelation for our faith, when what happens out there matches exactly what we are told will happen, that shouldn't really surprise us. It doesn't mean it's easy, but it's not meant to be easy. It's exactly what the Bible says. I think that first of all speaks to the truth of the Christian message, but it also speaks to the need to remain gracious and generous and forgiving and kind. At the same time, to be responsive and intelligent and nuanced and strategic in how we approach the public square. I don't want to pass judgment, but I think a lot of us, particularly in recent years, maybe in the last 20 or 30 years, we tend to kick and scream and, you know, behave quite neurotically when we're not well received or properly accommodated out there in the public square. And what do we expect? Everyone that puts any view in the public square gets knocked around by someone. Everyone's out there offending someone. There have been hilarious but important surveys and studies done where different groups of people have been surveyed on what they think and whom they think are the most persecuted or the most under threat or the most discriminated group in a given society. And something interesting about modern Western societies is that these studies generally show that any given group, whether it's the Christians or the atheists or whatever it might be, everyone thinks that their group is the most persecuted and under threat.
Really?
Yep. Everyone thinks they're the underdog. Everyone thinks that the rest of the society is against them. And part of that is a victimhood mentality that's actually grown.
Don't we hold a monopoly on the truth on that one? Aren't the Christians historically the most persecuted? Maybe I'm just biased. Maybe I'm in a bubble.
Historically, we can make other arguments. And historically, yeah, Christians have gone through a lot of terrible stuff. Of course, historically, people of other faiths and other, you know, belief systems have gone through terrible stuff too. But certainly today in modern Western society, not thinking historically, in modern Western market democracies, Christians are nowhere near any kind of persecution on any level. Even looking at the word persecution, it's actually quite offensive. And I know people who are Christians in countries where they're actually being persecuted, where there are actually heads rolling in the streets. And they are astonished that Christians in modern Western market democracies are whinging about, you know, particular aspects of it might be legal or political unrest or how we're treated in the public square or talked about.
First world persecution, right?
Absolutely. You know, when you lose your iPhone charger and you think it's the end of the world, I feel like a lot of Christians in parts of North Africa and the Middle East and the Orient, when you hear the stories of how they're actually treated, I personally find it offensive that we kick and scream about persecution in the West when we wouldn't know persecution, I think, if it walked up to us and introduced itself. So we have to be careful. It doesn't mean it's easy. I agree that, you know, things are not easy for a lot of people. And so we have to be respectful of that. But I think we have a bit of a persecution complex sometimes. I think we need to just harden up and get on with it.
But I was listening to a podcast of yours. I think you were doing the National Prayer Breakfast or something.
Yeah.
And you were talking about your story back in Sri Lanka and you, your family was, you know, genuinely persecuted.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very difficult time. And yeah, people can watch it on YouTube if they want the full story. But yeah, we had to leave Sri Lanka as refugees. We were caught up in the civil war.
How old were you then?
And I was just a few months old at that time.
Oh, okay.
So when we came to Australia, I was 1 year old. But that all happened when, yeah, I was just a few months old in 1983, what was called Black July. There were riots where there were kind of government-sanctioned paramilitary gangs that were told to go out there and attack and torture and kill Tamils. And so I'm a Tamil, which is pretty the largest minority ethnic group in Sri Lanka. I was in a civil war for a long time. And as a result of that, we fled the country, had our lives threatened, fled the country. And yeah, got a second chance in Australia, thankfully. So here we are.
Have you been back at all? Or
I've been back a couple of times.
Okay.
Yeah, did some speaking, only for work, actually. And so I've been back and it was nice to go back. It's obviously a country that I have very mixed feelings towards, but I really do feel for the Sri Lankan people, you know, for all of them. They have been through a lot. I mean, they're in a very difficult place economically and politically, and they've not been governed well over many, many years, to put it lightly. And so there's hope that they've turned a bit of a corner in the last few years. My prayers are regularly with them and their leaders, that kind of a new generation of Sri Lankan leadership from across different ethnic groups and religious groups can kind of take the country forward in a way that better serves its people.
And, you know, you said you've been back there a few times, ministry and stuff. I know you've traveled the world when you were with RZIM and whatnot, and you've ministered in the East and in the West. And how much have you had to really adapt your methodology or your apologetic or whatever based on whether we're in the East or the West? Is it drastically different?
Yeah, it's a good question, Todd. The short answer is it's not drastically different. And what I find, I think this might be an overly simplistic answer, but I think as our economies have integrated and globalized over the last, you know, 70 years, our psychological drivers and our cultural mindsets have globalized and integrated too, which means, you know, when I speak to a group of bankers in Hong Kong, it's a very similar set of issues and challenges and problems and questions that I get as when I'm speaking to a group of bankers in London. And it even starts to look more and more similar, you know, just because of people movements and multiculturalism and immigration being the way it is. More and more are big metropolitan centers all over the world, which are the primary places where I tend to be invited to speak. They're more and more similar. So there is that side of it. The fact that, you know, everyone's broadly streaming similar stuff on Netflix and Spotify and buying similar stuff on Amazon and watching similar stuff in movies and so forth helps all of that. That being said, there is one key difference that I do find that continues to be the case, notwithstanding that other homogenizing stuff I just mentioned. And that is that in the East, as a general principle, so this is, you know, throughout and in parts of, you know, when I speak in Africa and in Asia too, as compared with you know, Western Europe, the UK, US, Australia, New Zealand. In Eastern cultures, there's just a much broader assumption and acceptance of the transcendent and of the existence of God. And at the very least, if not that, then the existence of something beyond our material and physical world.
Okay.
And so even that is probably coming together more in the West. What we're seeing recently is a greater appetite and openness to the spiritual. And so that is definitely happening. There's been a bit of a resurgence in faith, or at the very least in explorations of faith. But yeah, that divide is still definitely there. Yeah, tend to be more comfortable with and open to the reality of God. What that means for them can look very different. You don't find many hard, grumpy atheists in the East.
Yeah, I can imagine. And when you're in the West and you know, dealing with your intellectuals and stuff, what do you find? Is there kind of a common barrier, a common, I don't know, objection to Christianity, to the faith that you're finding as you talk to people?
Yeah. Look, I think others that you might speak to in roles like mine might be able to point to one thing. I honestly don't think that there is. There hasn't been for me. There have been a common set of issues that are always there, but that set of issues tends to rise and fall in different ways. So what I mean is around 7 or 8 years ago, when I first started doing this kind of work, there was a lot of what you might call classical apologetics questions and issues around. So the big barriers were around suffering. They're around the historical legitimacy of the Bible. They're around evidence. You know, where's the rational evidence for what you believe? And how can we trust this? How can we believe this? If God's real, why is there suffering, et cetera, et cetera? Those questions are always there, but I think they were much more prevalent around 10 years ago. Now what I'm finding, particularly in, you know, modern industrial wealthier societies, is it's much more existential stuff. So the questions are much more about identity, purpose, meaning, less of a focus on is Christianity true, and a greater focus on does it work?
Yeah.
And what's it got for me?
Why do you think there's such a crisis in purpose and identity? People, you're saying more so now than 10, 15, 20 years ago, people are purposeless. There's no meaning, no hope, no whatever.
Yeah, well, I think the modern liberal project and everything within it has been been tried wholeheartedly by a lot of people. You know, we're coming up to probably three, maybe four generations now, and has been found wanting by more and more people. And so I think it's from an honest dissatisfaction and an honest hunger that appetite has grown. You know, people like Justin Briley in the UK wrote their book, The Surprising Resurgence of Faith in God, The Decline of New Atheism. These are trends that we're seeing not just in the UK. We're seeing it like across the very same OECD countries that the new atheists were on their soapboxes talking about declining faith in relation to some time ago. And so that decline, I mean, a lot of the recent data that we have suggests that decline has at the very least it's ceased, and in many countries it's reversed. And so there are in some countries hundreds and thousands of people who now are attending church or calling themselves Christian that weren't before. So this isn't just organic population growth type stuff. This is people that we have census data for from 5 or 10 years ago who identified as having no religion, that now identify as having a religion or even going to church or identifying as Christian. So there is a shift. Things are changing. And I think it's because the promises that we kind of made ourselves in the 70s and 80s and 90s, that if you just go out there and follow your desires and you do you, your best self, your best life with no objective reference points, kind of shifting God out of the way so you can effectively be the God over your own life, that just doesn't seem to have delivered in the way that many people had been told it would deliver. And that is breeding an understandable appetite and a hunger. Now, whether that is taken all the way to Christian belief is another question, right, but it certainly opens the door.
Is that, would you say, is that kind of the thrust, the heartbeat of your recent book, The Freedom Trap, that just came out a few months ago? Is that pursuit of freedom, whatever that might look like, has been empty and kind of counterproductive and increasing of anxiety and depression and dissatisfaction or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely, Todd. Thank you for raising that and giving me the opportunity to speak to it briefly. But yeah, you've summed it up pretty well. Like this idea of freedom, it's not actually an idea, it's an ideal. It's something that's a very positive thing, clearly. But if we take it to a logical extreme that goes beyond simply the absence of illegitimate constraints, and we actually make it about unlimited and unbridled autonomy, blind autonomy, if you like, where we are literally thinking of ourselves as a law unto ourselves, where life just becomes about the pursuit of desire based on how we feel, that I think quite clearly has been proven again and again to be a failing recipe. And so,
that's what Solomon wrote about, didn't he? Song of Songs, vanity, all is vanity.
Exactly. And so some of these trends that I've been talking about, so they're not just post-Cold War trends. These are things you can track all the way back to Solomon and even past him. When human beings are left with nothing else than their desires and the capacity to actualize those desires, that never ends well. That never ends well. And so quickly, and this is what my book really explores, we understand. I mean, you could find it from the Bible or you could just find it from human experience.
Max, let me pause you for a second. I don't mean to be rude and interrupt. Back in the 80s, there was a guy named Max Headroom that was kind of very pixelated. And that's what you're doing on the podcast right now. I don't know if that's going to show up in the final cut or if the internet connection needs a bit jigging or.
No, I think it's going to be okay. This happens sometimes.
Does it? Okay. Well, give me 1 second because the owner of this this place just showed up. Let me pause this and I hope I'm paused. Am I paused? So here we are. I don't remember what we were last talking about.
We were talking about the Freedom Trap.
Interrupted. What your book? The Freedom Trap. Yeah. How's that been received?
I've been very grateful. I have a great team around me. Very robust, but very gracious. A kind of editorial writing team among my colleagues and a great publisher in Acorn Press, which are a great little publisher based here in Australia. So it's been good. It's been fun. And I think that the message is resonating. These aren't, you know, audaciously new ideas, but they're newly packaged up in a way that I hope are accessible and helpful for people.
I just found out about it when I read the bottom of your email the other day. So, wow. And so I Googled it and whatnot, and I read the first chapter, the free chapter. And I love, Max, the way you put so many stories in it.
I'm glad.
The stories were good. Yeah, no. So good. I'll probably get the book and read all the stories and, you know, the points behind them. But yeah, good on that. Yep. So let's see. How do you deal with, like, we talked about, you know, being in the public sphere so much, but how do you deal with when you're giving truth claims, because you unashamedly bring forth the truth of Christianity and the gospel, but people that say that it's narrow or it's, you know, exclusivistic or just whatever it might be, intolerant or even outdated. How do you deal with that? What do you have to say to them?
Yeah, look, I think
if you get those kind of,
I think pushbacks. The most important thing, to the degree that we can, is to try and find out, especially if it's an individual, what's driving that. Like, why do they think it's arrogant and exclusive? Because in their minds and hearts, at least, they've got good reasons for thinking that. So I think empathy is an important first pivot. Otherwise, you find yourself kind of responding to a question that you might have misunderstood, or you might have misunderstood the motivation behind it. So just blindly defending for defense's sake is, I've found, not particularly productive. And so to find out where they are, to meet them where they are, and then to speak into that, I think is a good. Exactly. Work out what they're
kind
actually
of the questioner asking,
what's
behind
the reason
question.
For the question, and ask why they're asking. Ask yourself why they're asking it, and engage with them as a person rather than as a question or an objection. But then I think the fundamental place you want to come to is to make clear, and this might be done in answering a question or in a talk or over a friendship that might last for many months or years, but you really kind of want to make the point as graciously as we can that the claims that it's arrogant and exclusive can't really hold, because it can't be arrogant if it's true, and it can't be exclusive if it's for everyone. And the Christian message.
Say that again. Can't be arrogant if it's true,
yeah.
And it can't
so
be exclusive if
those
it's for
two
everyone.
Things kind of put to rest, you know, those claims. But if people have a vision of or an understanding of the Christian message that it is arrogant and exclusive, then that's clearly a misunderstanding. And so I think the responsibility for the Christian in the conversation, whether that's a public or a national conversation or a one-on-one conversation, is to try and work out how and why it's been misunderstood and misinterpreted. Because, you know, in my view, when you look at the Bible and you look at the message of Jesus, it's neither arrogant nor exclusive, because it's for everyone and it's true. So
the offer is, but certainly have. I just was listening to a podcast by Wesley Huff, and he had like 26 or several atheists around him having a go at him. And they were really drilling down on, didn't Jesus say, I am the way and the truth and the life? And, you know, isn't heaven an exclusive, you know, there's an exclusive path. And so there's kind of a truth
there is
in that, isn't there?
Exclusive truth that's claimed by Christianity, but it's not an exclusive faith. It's not closed off to people. So it claims exclusive truth, but it doesn't extend that exclusively to people. It's extended to all of humankind. Everyone's invited into relationship with God. And so I think that's the more important thing to focus on, is that everyone's invited. It's not like some party where only some people are invited. That would be exclusive. But the fact that everyone's invited, you know, no matter who you are, that is necessarily non-exclusive. But on the more rational, philosophical point that it's a truth claim that's therefore exclusive, yeah, I think that's fine. But we can also then make the point graciously that all truth claims are exclusive. And even the claim that all religions are equally true is an exclusive truth claim, because it excludes anyone that thinks that all religions are not exclusively true. So all truth claims aren't necessarily exclusive, which is why what's more important is not so much whether it's exclusive as a truth claim. What's more important is whether or not it's true, and then who that truth applies to. And on those first principle levels, the Christian story is a rich and beautiful and compelling one, because it is backed by evidence, a relational, historical, philosophical, archaeological, anthropological, anecdotal, et cetera, all of the evidence. And it's open to everyone. And everyone's invited into the story and into this relationship with God and loving relationship with other people. So I think there's a lot that can be said. I think that the key for the Christian is not to be arrogant and exclusive in answering the question of whether or not Christianity is arrogant and exclusive. I think the form with which we engage with these sorts of questions and objections is just as important, sometimes even more important than the substance with which we engage. And I think a lot of us through history and even now, we are constantly running the risk, and I'm no exception to that, that when our faith is objected to or attacked or mocked, we respond instinctively, which is in a way that might be objectionable or mocking or attacking ourselves, which is hugely problematic because it doesn't represent the Christian story particularly well in form or substance.
Right. Right. Something I kind of was curious about, and I'd read that you're active in talking about and discussing around AI and ethics. And I don't know, how should Christians think about technology and their advancement of technology with spiritual implications and moral implications? I mean, I haven't heard any of your talks on that, to my shame.
Yeah, it's clearly enormously important, and it's going to have and is already having massive implications for us as a species, economically, culturally, politically, psychologically, relationally. All of those things are very real and they're there. But I disagree with this view that AI is kind of going to be the ruin of humankind. I think we're pretty much ruined already, pretty well ruined. We don't need any help with that. We've seen to that.
We've
seen to
that
in every generation, every civilization, at every age. So we're already pretty well broken and messed up in the most fundamental ways. But this is a significant shift. It's been talked about as the biggest shift to information production since the printing press. But I think there's much more to it than that, just because so much of our global economy is digitalized at the moment, and AI plays right into that space. And so I think there are huge implications. There are also massive implications because of the accessibility of large language models and of various aspects of AI for increasingly everyday people. So there's an enormous global middle class and an even bigger global working class and a small upper class, and AI will necessarily and is already necessarily infiltrating and affecting and impacting all of those classes just because of global digitalization. So it's a huge thing. It can be a great good if we use it in areas to alleviate suffering and in areas of kind of medical technologies and in areas of how we deliver services, integrity in our systems and our institutions. We can really use it to create efficiencies and productivity dividends, which can be a wonderful thing in the context of wealth creation and information creation and the distilling of information and those sorts of things. But as is always the case, there's enormous risks and challenges, you know, relationally with people, you know, using AI as a substitution for another person in terms of relationship, trying to build authentic friendships with the chatbot, people losing aspects of our own human intelligence because we're ceding that to artificial intelligence, doing things that we should be doing for ourselves, aspects of the creative enterprise of humankind, you know, art in all of its forms.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking, I've got a young man, a friend of mine that's just entering seminary, and I said, what are they warn or heed, you know, what warning do you have to heed about using, you know, ChatGPT or whatever to answer an essay prompt? Because it would be so easy to put your essay prompt in there and boom, there it is. And if you're at a secular university,
you're absolutely right. This education is a great example. The education sector is right at the front of the fight and the arm wrestle, if you like. And so I think one good thing about AI is that it will force all of us in all sectors to kind of go back to first principles. You know, like, what's education for? What do we want people coming out with? They have to rethink our assessments, rethink how we do things, rethink information creation, rethink how we hire. And ultimately what that all comes back to, when in the kind of work that you and I are involved in, Todd, it really all goes back upstream to the fundamental question of what does it mean to be human? And so I think that's the big question for AI and for humankind in relation to AI is, how do we establish and honor and elevate intrinsic human dignity, inalienable and objective intrinsic human dignity, and make sure that our technology doesn't erode that or doesn't cause that to decay? This is actually what my PhD is on. So it's a bit of a kind of hobby horse for me, but I think that's where it all starts and that's where we will all finish with AI.
Is there a groundswell with that concern?
No, thankfully there's a groundswell. It's not even a particularly Christian groundswell. There are Christian voices making the points that we're talking about, which you would expect and hope would be the case, but lots of other people are too. And people have tried to come together. You know, there's been early conferences on AI and ethics and trying to put together ethical charters for AI, and governments are grappling with it and regulational bodies are grappling with it. So everyone gets it that we have to be on our game ethically and normatively, but there's a lot, a long way to go, and we need to have our wits about us.
Would you say we've got to get behind this thing, or in front of this thing rather, because
correct.
I mean, the horse has already
bolted.
We've
got to be very careful and we've got to be very protective, especially of vulnerable people, of young people. There's a lot to think about. in terms of the damage that can be done. We already have horrific examples of people committing suicide, you know, because of a conversation they've had with the chatbot. There's been all kinds of problems. We've already seen self-driving cars cause fatalities on the road. So there's all kinds of things that we just need to be aware of. And I don't think there's a need to run away from it, but there is a need to approach it very carefully and thoughtfully, and for Christians, prayerfully and theologically as well, to make sure that it actually does work towards the flourishing of people.
Yeah. And there is such potential for it, you know, huge potential for it and all that. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to, and this again is kind of a personal question, and it has to do with your stint with RZIM and, you know, the organization that went through such a painful and public crisis. What were some of the takeaways that you gained from that? What were some of the things you left with out of, boy, I'll make sure I never do this or always do this or whatever? Any lessons in leadership or lessons in, you know, trust?
It's a fair question. That was a very difficult time and came, you know, obviously as an enormous shock when it all happened, and a very kind of discouraging time. And there was just a lot of grief, to be honest, and sorrow and amid the shock of all of that. The big thing that I took out of it, you know, apart from the emotional side of it, is that having worked in the kind of public and private sector, first in law and then in politics, and then gone into this kind of work of kind of parachurch Christian work, if you like, and this is an oversimplification, but I think this trend is true. Out there in the public and private sectors of the economy, generally speaking, trust is quite low. And because of that, accountability mechanisms and systems and frameworks are quite high. There tends to be more accountability. I mean, particularly in law and politics, there's just an enormous amount of accountability there because trust is very low. So we have things like elections and Senate estimates hearings and a free press and interrogations and freedom of information requests and all kinds of things. And in the law, we have discovery and we have inquisitories and interrogatories. These are all ways of just getting the information out there. So there's just much more transparency. There are tribunals, there are hierarchies. There are, you know, accreditations, there are all kinds of things. So out there, trust is relatively low. And because of that, accountability, at least in the spheres where I worked in Australia, is relatively high. Whereas in faith-based ecosystems and faith-based environments, at least the ones that I've worked in, trust tends to naturally be higher. And because of that, accountability is relatively low. And that was certainly the case. Yeah, which is kind of
a dangerous combination, isn't it?
What the world out there does, and the world out there actually, in that sense, has a much better grasp on the human condition and human brokenness. It's much truer to the biblical anthropology that we see of human brokenness, that ideally you want to get to a place where trust is very high and accountability is very high. You shouldn't have to choose one or the other. But if you're going to have to choose one, choose accountability, because people generally are more often than not trustworthy than trustworthy. Whether they are or not as individuals, you can't bank on the trustworthiness of people when you're setting up organizations and growing organizations. And I think that's the big thing that I took away from it. And I was quite young in public speaking and writing. So I was new to that space. And that was a huge shock, but also a huge lesson. And for all of the pain that so many went through, particularly the survivors themselves who were affected. I mean, we were secondarily affected as employees, but for all of that pain, that was an important lesson that I took from it.
Yeah. Did you have a hard time when you came out of that trusting your pastor?
Definitely. Or had a hard time trusting anyone.
I could imagine you would.
Particularly people who call themselves Christians.
I can just imagine. Wow. Big shock like that. There was an article I read that was very cool. It was called "In a World Overwhelmed by the Demand of Work, Bluey Reminds Us of the Ethical Importance of Play." You go on. You said, "We need to enjoy things for their own sake. We need fun. We need play. We need kindness." So what does that look for you, your family? I mean, what does fun look like? Fun for its fun sake. What keeps you with a smile on the dial? Because, you know, too much work or anything's going to sour
us. Have both spoken even earlier in this discussion about the challenges out there. You know, there are culture wars out there. There's a sometimes pretty divisive and polarizing and polarized public square out there. People of faith are, you know, continuously, I didn't for a second mean to talk it down earlier, they're continuously and quite regularly often under threat and under criticism and have to deal with stereotypical judgments and stuff like that. And so I think it would be quite easy to just buy into all of that with a kind of combative mindset And I think that really runs against the grain of the kind of vision of life that God wants for his people and for all people. And so that's why I think fun and kindness are kind of a helpful starting point. And so, you know, for me and my family and for my colleagues and my friends and the work that I do, we try and I try and remember, I got some very good advice early in my career that you're never as good or as bad as they say you are. And so, yeah, that's right.
As good or as bad,
yeah.
Huh?
And so we get outdoors
a lot. But what do you do? Are you an outdoors family?
We're back in Australia for a couple of years now. So we've been living in Sydney for 2 years. And Sydney's just been a great city to be outdoors in. So we spent a lot of time at the beach doing a bit of camping.
Oh, imagine.
About three young kids and they're at the ages where skateboarding and rollerblading and scooting and all of those things are front and center. So, yeah, we're outdoors a lot. We watch movies. And so.
What are you watching? I mean, I remember before you gave me the tip on watching The West Wing. So I got it on Amazon and that was a good
me recommending that, Todd. What series would you recommend? Following up on it is one of the great achievements of my life. I feel I'm so pleased that I could recommend someone to The West Wing and commend it to someone. Yeah, look, I watch a lot of old stuff actually. Like I watch like old comedy, like Jerry Seinfeld stuff. And that sort of thing. I still dust off The West Wing and rewatch that every couple of years. That's a lot of fun. But I like to watch movies. I just watch whatever people are watching. You know, I talked about, and you mentioned my article on Bluey. Part of the reason I wrote that is because Bluey was just exploding at the time. And so I thought it was just an easy way to relate to people. And it was. So I tend to just see what people are into and up for and just enjoy that. I enjoy a good glass of wine with my wife, Fiona. We're building friendships and community here in Sydney now. And so, yeah, there's a lot to be grateful for, a lot to enjoy and a lot of fun to be had, even amid the swirling uncertainty and challenges that we all face.
Yeah. Turning the corner just a teeny bit on a spiritual level. I mean, we talk about, you know, I like to skateboard.
Nice.
I have electric skateboards and I'm really into that. That helps. I love it. So what about on a spiritual level? What recharges you spiritually? What brings a freshness to your walk or relationship with Christ? If there's anything
I think
could give advice about.
Recharging and freshness is essential for me and I think for most people. I think the mistake that I used to make is thinking that I just need to, whenever I'm running low, recharge. And I think there is a time for those catalytic kind of experiences like a camp or a conference or a retreat. So, you know, I've done silent retreats before and I sometimes take a half day or whatever I can. I mean, this stage of life, that's harder and harder, but to do that. But I think the key to recharging and to answer your question, Todd, is that it happens every single day. I think that's the key. And so for me, recharging is about, yes, some physical exercise, but then just some spiritual exercise, some time quietly with God in scripture and meditating on his word and talking to him and then listening in silence. It sounds kind of overly simplistic, but
No, and it sounds I think like the ascetics, the monks that used to do it, you know,
something the monks didn't do, which was to be out there on Main Street in the real world, culturally and economically and politically. I think doing both of those things is what does it for me. And so I talk about what we do at the Center for Public Christianity is that we kind of exegete culture, we exegete scripture, and then we exposit them in relation to one another. And for me to be able to do that, I need to be, and I'm not saying I do this all the time perfectly, but when I'm on my game, I'm putting in time with the Lord every single day. And so that's really important. And then secondary to that, but very important too, is to just be plugged in, you know, to a Jesus-loving community. And my wife Fiona and I are blessed with one another and with a great church family and a growing kind of community around us here. And every city we've lived in and we've moved to different countries and been all over the shop, everywhere we go, that's our priority, is to kind of find those people. And then to also make sure that they're not our only people, that we have a life beyond that. I think, journeying through life as a Christian, journeying through life and sharing life with other followers of Jesus is pretty key for that spiritual health and refreshment.
Yeah. What do you see on the horizon? I mean, are you a planner? I mean, do you have a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year
plan? I used to be, Todd. I think when I was a younger man,
some people are.
I had all kinds of great plans. Okay. And then I look back on my life now and I realize, you know, how little they play out and how things can just come out of nowhere. And so I think I'm growing in wisdom. So I'm just kind of.
So why bother?
I have a plan for what I'm having for lunch today after I finish this interview with you. And even that, you know,
sounds
I might walk out there and one of my colleagues might have eaten it. So I try to hold things loosely, but hold the important things firmly and then leave the rest up to God.
Yeah. Fair enough. Fair enough. Very good. So listen, if you could leave a bit of advice for, and I don't know, I've never asked anybody this, but a young Max Jagannatha, that what would you tell yourself in order to, you know, this is a different environment altogether, but what bit of advice for a young person, maybe a young person like the way you used to think as a young teenager?
Yeah, well, that's a tough question. It's a whole other book.
What do you think?
All right.
It kind of is. Maybe I've inspired your next step in life.
I certainly don't have enough life experience to write that book, but I can. I mean, just a couple of thoughts. I definitely tell them never believe how good or bad they say you are. I think that's held me firm. I think it's very important that we don't get too discouraged and we don't get too big headed for ourselves. I think I would say that at its simplest level, true flourishing and happiness comes from investing in your relationship with God and investing in your relationships with the people around you. And that kind of cross-shaped relational focus is pretty basic to the Christian life and the Christian message. And there's a reason for that. And so I think I would tell them to just build your whole life around those two things, those relationships. And then I think thirdly, I would say lean into your gifts and strive for excellence in what you're gifted in.
Yeah, I parrot that all the time, man. That's been a lifesaver for me. Just being who you are, right. Not somebody else, not some gifted speaker, apologist,
and it's good to
prophet,
have hobbies and
whatever,
things that you're interested in. But I think we lie to a lot of our younger selves and our kids, saying you can do anything you want and be anything you want. And we want to be encouraging and you want to be supportive. But the reality is that not everyone's cut out to make a living doing whatever they want. I'm 5 foot seven, I think, Todd, and I would love to have been in the NBA by now. I'd love to have retired from the NBA by now, but that was just never going to happen. So I think telling younger people, and told my younger self to just be realistic about your weaknesses and your strengths, lean into your strengths and your gifts and see how you can serve God and serve other people with them.
I love it. Yeah. Because that's when you're most fulfilled anyway.
I think that's right. And I don't think we can do whatever we want with our lives. I think we would do well at doing what we are gifted to do and called to do. And that might be, that could still be a number of things. It might be five or six things over a lifetime. It might be 10 things, but it's certainly not anything and everything. And I think being realistic about that keeps things simpler. We're not here to conquer the world. We're here to love God, love each other, have fun along the way. Yeah.
Pretty easy. Max, thank you for your time. Thanks for just being you, buddy. You bring to the table, you bring a lot of experience, you bring a lot of expertise, but you bring your heart. And I appreciate that, you know, the truthfulness and the honesty. It's been great having you on the podcast. For those of you out there that are listening and watching, if you want to know a little more about Max, you can find some of the articles and things he's doing for the at publicchristianity.org. And for the rest of you, make sure you subscribe to the Thinking Matters channel, and I will see you next time on the podcast. I look forward to it. I hope to see you there.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.